Leading Edge Medicine provides only general medical information. Since everyone's individual situation is unique, you should consult your own physician before taking any action related to your personal health. All content of this program is intended for general informational purposes only. Good morning and welcome to Leading Edge Medicine with Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat. Leading Edge Medicine is sponsored by Longevity Medical Clinics and is devoted to helping you feel and function better tomorrow than you do today by providing the newest and most advanced medical care designed to improve both your body and your brain. Leading Edge Medicine will keep you informed regarding the very latest developments in science and medicine while highlighting some of the Northwest's most prominent physicians. All while helping you separate the science from the silly and the facts from the fiction. This is live call-in radio at its very best, giving you the opportunity to participate in the show. Now, here are your hosts for Leading Edge Medicine, Dr. Jerry Mixon and Dr. Samira Umat, along with their co-host, Lynette Morgan.
Are here with Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette, and I am so excited because we have the studio filled with doctors today. Dr. Jerry Mixon here, Dr. Samira Umat, and Dr. Umat, would you introduce
our wonderful doctor? Absolutely. We have Dr. Christine Brazel here today.
Yes.
From our Kirkland team. Yes, Dr. Woo-hoo. Brazel, welcome to the show again.
Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to see you all.
Yeah.
Yes. I think last time you were in, I was on vacation. So that was last year.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I didn't get to meet Dr. Brazel, because we've had several listeners call in and say, oh, yeah, Dr. Brazel is my doctor. And so, yeah welcome
and
to
they
your
always
show.
Tell me.
Yes.
We have some great patients out there.
Oh, we certainly do. So, and we love it when they call in on our show. And I'm going to go ahead and give that phone number right now so that you can be one of the first ones through. On the line, lines are wide open for you. 800, let's see, here is the number to call, 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770 with your questions for Dr. Mixon, Dr. Umat, or Dr. Brazel. So why don't we get introduced to you, Dr. Brazel? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and why you love doing it?
Well, I've been here at Longevity and closing in on 5 years in the next couple of weeks. Very exciting. I think I moved here to Washington 5 years ago, and I found this, looked for a job, and I saw this ad that looked intriguing, and I thought, well, I can't not check that out. That looks amazing. And then, lo and behold, Dr. Mixon called me, I believe, the next day and said, I'd like to meet you. And then the rest is history.
There you go.
My last interview went very, very well. And then, so since I've been here, of course, I've been doing the program that everyone is used to doing, which is, for many of our newer members, is called the Premier, and then we've elaborated to the Platinum Plan. But I was doing hormone replacement and weight loss for a long time in Phoenix. So I've been in practice 16 years and 5 here in Washington. So I have definitely adapted to the seasons because I'm a New England girl. So this is mild for me.
That was my next question is how do you like the seasons here as compared to sunshine all the time in Phoenix?
Well, I do admit that in February I was wishing I had made a vacation trip to see friends and family, but only for about a week. And then the sun's coming out, so we're all very excited to see the sun this weekend.
Absolutely.
This is going to be an amazing weekend. Yeah.
It's going to be so nice. So looking forward to that. Yeah. Yes.
So as many of my patients know, I'm an avid gardener, so I'm looking forward to getting out there with the daffodils this weekend everything ready for the summer. So that's going to be really exciting. That's what I do in my own time. And, of course, bicycling. And I love food, so I love to spend a lot of time cooking, learning new recipes, and teaching people about ways they can make healthier choices at home that don't have to be difficult.
Are you growing in your garden, Dr. Brazel?
Yes.
Well, right now, interestingly, I left a collard green from last fall. I didn't pick it, and so I put it under some plastic covers, and I open them up, and it's gigantic and has the most beautiful, large, leafy green that I've ever seen. So the slugs didn't get to them yet, so I'm about to get to them this afternoon.
Okay, yes. I think a lot of us will be outside, either walking or in the yard, doing something. So And you said you like to cook. So have you jumped on the sourdough bread craze? Because a lot of folks seem to be making sourdough bread.
I admit that I have dabbled a little bit, but me and sourdough starter don't get along yet. And that's like having a family pet. You don't just get to use it when you want it. You're always feeding it,
yes,
watering it, seeing
moving
if it
wants it around.
To get baked.
And, yeah. My daughter's been doing this and her friends. And then at work yesterday, I came in and there were a couple of bowls with the towels across them. So I thought, okay, they're bringing their pets to work.
But I appreciate that so many people here make the wonderful sourdough.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So because of that, my husband, I believe, will be stopping at Snohomish Bakery on the way up to Everett this morning.
Oh, that's an amazing bakery.
Mm. My favorite place. And so I just said, when you're there, let's get an extra bread.
Yes.
And I know bread isn't always on our high list of things to eat, but it's not on our never list of things.
You know,
that's right.
Last week we had some technical difficulties, but we got a question on bread. And Jerry and I said, well, we love bread.
Yes, we do. Yes.
Yeah. And it's sometimes way too much.
Yeah. And it, like you said, you shouldn't do it every day, all the time. But if you're going to do it, do it well,
what?
Right? You know, do the good stuff.
Well, there's a little math involved in bread versus pounds per square inch.
Yes.
There sure is, sadly.
Yep. Yeah. Very good. Okay, well, welcome, Dr. Brazel. Glad
Thank
you're
you.
Here. Let me give that phone number again for questions. 1-800-465-8770. And Dr. Mixon, what's been going on this week in medical news?
Well, kind of interesting. The Washington State Board of Health and the Medical Board are being sued.
Oh.
Because for violations of freedom of speech, because during COVID, if doctors told the truth instead of the government propaganda, they were sanctioned by the medical board. And so, you know, the medical board punished doctors for saying that, you know, this face covering foolishness does no good because face coverings are not properly fitted N95 masks. You know, but the state of Washington was saying you can't go in a restaurant unless you cover your face. Well,
yes,
that's stupid. And doctors who said it was stupid, some of them got sanctioned by the state board for, quote, misinformation. And, you know, the lawsuit is basically saying that government agencies like medical boards don't have a right to decide what professionals are allowed to say and not to say. You cannot punish people in America for exercising their right to have an opinion and express that opinion, especially when their opinion happens to be true and the government opinion happens to be stupid and a lie. So, yeah.
Wow.
So I think it's kind of interesting that, I think even more fascinating, the lawsuit is being brought on behalf of some physicians that were sanctioned, but the person behind the lawsuits is a basketball player.
Mm.
He happened to have enough money. The doctors don't have enough money.
No, but the basketball player.
To do a multi-million dollar lawsuit against the state of Washington. So, basketball players make a lot more money than doctors.
So. Wow.
Okay. Well, all professional athletes make a lot more money than doctors, Jerry.
I know. I saw a little blurb the other day. Somebody, and I forget who because I don't know any athletes, but I saw a little blurb. Somebody just signed a 4-year, $180 million contract.
Well, no, the biggest one was in soccer for $700 million.
Yeah, well, I just saw a blurb said, you know, 4-year, $180 million contract with a guarantee if he's hurt and can't play, that he gets still $100 million.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there saying, oh, my God.
I can't play basketball or soccer. I would do it for half that.
Yeah.
You know? Okay, fine, a quarter. $25 million, and I won't play
physician.
It. Yes.
I look at some of these incomes of people who play games for a living.
Yeah.
It just boggles my mind.
Yeah.
You know, how dare you make a good living, you know, saving people's lives, but you should be, you know, playing games and we'll reward you richly.
Yeah. No, I mean, on the flip side, too, though, their career is very small window. They don't have that whole span like a physician
does. Excuse me, but I have been in practice for 48 years.
I'm not making excuses, and I don't know any professional athlete. I think it's ugly.
I understand. But after 48 years of practice, I can look back and say, I have not earned a tiny fraction of that much money in my entire life put together.
It is true for the vast majority, if not all physicians.
That's right. And if you have a surgery.
We would never see that kind of money.
Our our priorities are just seriously screwed up in this
country. Well, residency, the whole journey is such a long journey. You have to love medicine to do medicine. If you don't love medicine, for anybody out there who's advising somebody who's young, please tell them that if they don't love the thought of doing medicine, don't go into it.
That's right.
It's not for the money.
It's definitely not for the money. You make a lot more money coding for Microsoft
than you do
as a physician.
Right. Or if you're an athlete.
or if you're an actor and you make your living pretending to be brave, pretending to be smart, pretending to have talent, you make a lot more money than people who really do.
That's called acting, Jerry.
Yes, I know.
Wow.
I'm not sure if Oppenheimer was really as famous as he was as his compared to his movies.
Yeah.
That's right.
But we all now know who he is.
My gosh, it was a clean sweep.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah, and we all know who Cillian Murphy is, even though he's been around for a while.
Yeah.
That played Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, well.
Okay, are you ready for some phone calls? Because we got some folks ready to jump in.
Let's do it.
Nice.
Okay. All right. Well, Dr. Brazel, you were mentioning Arizona, so we're going to head to Arizona with our first call today.
Uh-oh.
Yes. John is on the line.
Hello.
And he has a question for us. Hi, John.
Can you hear me?
Sure can. Welcome. What can we do to help you?
Hello.
Hello, John. Speak. We hear you.
All right. Maybe he can't hear us.
He can't hear us. Yeah. Whatever they've got going on at the studio
it's not working. There we go. Can you hear us?
Can you hear us, John? No, apparently John cannot hear us, Mr. Engineer at the studio.
Yes, sir.
Hey, get rid of this absolutely hysterical hiss that we are hearing in our headphones.
Yes, more technical issues.
And let our patient hear us talk to them, please.
There we go. Okay, well, we're going to keep talking. John, you stay on the line. I know you're listening on the radio. You can hear us. We can't hear you. We're going to get that fixed in just a few moments.
No. We can hear him. He can't hear us when we speak on the microphones.
That's right. Okay, so John, if you're listening and you can hear us, go ahead and let us know what's going on.
No, he can't hear us.
He can't hear us, Lynette.
Yeah.
Well, not via the phone. He might be able to hear us.
Via the radio. Yeah, but that's about 9 seconds. Okay, you know what? We're going to take our first break right now. So let's take a quick break, and hopefully we can get this taken care of.
Please, engineer, fix it so we don't hear the hiss and the patients can hear us.
There we go. Okay, stay right there. And, John, you hang on the line. It's Leading Edge Medicine. Good morning. I'm Lynette, and we are waiting for an engineer. So we're going to continue talking, and I want John, who's on the line waiting patiently, and Bob on the line waiting patiently. Stay right there, because we're going to get to you as soon as we can.
As soon as the station finishes their technical... problems.
Yes, I want to look at the board so bad. Okay. Well, this happens, but you know what? We've got three amazing doctors here in the studio. Why don't you pick a topic, Dr. Umat? Here we are.
Well, there's lots of things to talk about, actually.
Yes.
So we're not short of topics, that's for sure.
That's true.
And I know that, you know, Dr. Brazel is our guest today, and she has a passion for cardiovascular disease.
Ooh.
And we do a lot to help identify cardiac disease and then to help manage it. And then, of course, we use our colleagues with the cardiologists to help us manage our patients' care. But Dr. Brazel, do you want to talk a little bit about cardiac disease and managing and preventing progression of cardiovascular disease? How do we identify some of those things that people don't know that they really should know?
Well, thanks for asking. And of course, please jump in with questions if you have something you want me to focus in on. For my patients who already see me here, they know that I take their cardiovascular risk very seriously. Mm. And it's personal because my father died at 51 of a heart attack.
Wow.
And back in the early 90s, they just didn't have the science or the way to understand how to prevent these things. So it hit me when I was young, and it's always been a little bit in the back of my mind for our family. How do we keep this from happening to us? And I didn't know I was going to become a doctor until I was much older. And I went to school in Arizona as a naturopathic doctor. We talk a lot about prevention there, and prevention is your first defense. But prevention doesn't happen because people see their doctor when they're already having problems. Mm-hmm. So if young people saw their doctor regularly in their 20s, they would know that they were getting high blood pressure, high blood sugar, high cholesterol. And now with the epidemic of obesity, all of those numbers add up to high risk for cardiovascular disease, which is congestive heart failure, or atherosclerosis, the stuff that causes the heart attacks, but also strokes and also dementia, we now understand, is strongly linked to the progression of these diseases. But they don't start in your 60s or 70s.
Right.
They start in your 20s and 30s, or for a lot of women around perimenopausal change, which can start as early as the late 30s or early 40s, these numbers start climbing up.
Right. You know, most people think they're invincible in their 20s. Nothing can go wrong.
They do.
And that's why prevention for somebody in their 20s is not a focus. Yet, if there is a family history and if they know that they may have a genetic predisposition to something, they should be on high alert very early.
Yes.
Because that's the time when they can actually change their future.
So one of the things we do offer to our patients that are coming in is something called the APOE test. And this is a gene everybody has.
Okay.
And this gene has different versions. So you can get two copies, one from mom, one from dad. And the APOE2 is considered fairly protective against cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's. APOE3, the most common, is moderate risk. Everyone's a little bit at risk. And then APOE4 is high risk. Mm. And so what we now know more about this gene is it's strongly related to cholesterol metabolism. And so when I see my patients carry that, I work really hard at getting their cholesterol numbers even lower than their primary care doctor would have them have, because I don't want to be in the business of prescribing them more and more medications if we can head it off at the pass. And,
yes.
And definitely preventing that first cardiovascular event, which is more likely to show up early in these patients. So they don't always live long enough to get that Alzheimer's disease because they're much higher risk for strokes and heart attack.
Wow.
But okay. So is everyone in America now.
Yes.
So it's not like you're low risk because you don't have the gene. It just means you're still high risk. I think we have 70% of the population will die from one of these diseases, a heart attack or a congestive heart failure, or with it.
Okay.
When they get old enough. So if we can slow that down in your 40s and 50s, I'm all for it. Then you get to 90 feeling good instead of bad.
Yeah. I mean, with congestive heart failure, it just takes away so much quality of life.
Yeah.
And, you know, people associate it with old age, but really you're laying down the foundation of it happening at a very young age. So, and just to describe it a little bit, cardiac ejection fraction is less. So you basically don't get perfusion to the rest of the body, to the brain, to the lungs, and then you get swelling at night. So you're balancing, always teetering, tottering on how much diuretic to take and how much activity and how salts to take. And it's always a balance. And if with that you have a cardiac rhythm disturbance, like you go into AFib or something like that, then you're just confused and tired and short of breath all the time. And that's no way to live.
You used a term, though, that I think much of our audience doesn't understand, this cardiac ejection fraction.
Okay.
Yes. What is that?
And perfusion. We should explain that as well. Yeah.
All right.
Because the big ventricles, the pumping chambers, the ejection fraction is what percentage of the volume of that does it effectively pump with each stroke of the heart.
Right.
And so some people, as they get older, because they've had a lot of small heart attacks and have damaged part of the muscle, or the blood supply is simply not adequate, so the muscle is not functioning strongly enough, or because their testosterone, the anabolic load, is too low and they simply don't have the strength in that heart muscle, because after all, the heart is a muscle, and the anabolic hormones like testosterone, DHEA, are critical for maintaining muscle strength. Mm-hmm. And that's why women get about twice as many congestive heart failure problems as men, mm-hmm. because they start with lower testosterone loads than men do. So that ejection fraction, that percentage of the blood pumped with each beat of the heart, mm-hmm. is critically important.
That's right.
And you bring up a good point about women. So with the congestive heart failure, there's numerous inroads into it. A lot of women that are very thin get congratulated and no one checks them for heart disease. And very thin, underweight women, yeah. with small muscle mass, with osteoporosis, are really high risk for the congestive heart failure, because if your leg muscles are small, your heart muscles are even smaller. You can exercise all day long and still have a thin, slightly weakened heart. But those women don't get screened because they look great.
They look great and they look healthy.
And they don't want to believe that exercising too much, which they often do, isn't protective, which we now know it isn't.
Yeah. So, and that's one of the reasons that women need testosterone, and they yeah. need it early, because their levels start declining in their 30s, just like men. But they start it with about 1/12 as much testosterone as men do. So their decline ends up with very low levels much younger. And that makes their muscles weaker, but it makes their heart weaker.
Yeah. And it also gives them lower motivation to get off the couch. We already have enough things to do. But if you're feeling tired all the time because that blood flow, the perfusion that Samira was talking about, isn't making it to your brain or to your heart or your legs, you're not going to have the oxygen to do the job. And it's that vicious cycle, the less you move. But overexercise can also cause damage. So overdoing it on one day doesn't solve it. It's the movements that up.
The weekend warriors tend to do more damage than they realize. So it's ongoing, you know, and we've seen that even in the blue zones, where people are active every day for doing little things all the time that are considered to be good in the long term mm-hmm. for them. And again, building muscle mass is critical. And we keep saying that muscle is the currency of aging, much more so than you would realize.
That's right.
Speaking of the blue zones, did you watch the documentary on Netflix?
I did.
So what was really nice about it, I've been talking to my patients about this for a few years. So.
And what is a blue zone?
Blue zone is a place in the world. There's five of them that have been formally identified, and they might be growing the number, where a lot of the population compared to other places lives to 100 years old in good health.
So the highest percentage of 100-year-olds than anywhere in the world. They first started with Okinawa, Japan, and then Loma Linda, California, Santorini, Greece, Ikaria, Greece, and then Costa Rica,
Nicoya,
Costa Rica are some of those places.
And Sardinia,
yeah.
And these are tend to be hilly places.
Yes. They're remote, except for Loma Linda.
Yeah.
But Loma Linda is just one of those places, though, that is very upscale, and people are very body conscious. Yeah. You know, they exercise a lot. They're moving a lot.
Yeah, the sense of community is what I came away with. Yeah.
Well, strongly related to the Seventh Adventist Church, who teaches these principles of health and community.
Plant-based, mostly vegetarian, but more a community and socially connected group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they can be outside all the time, and they also get to grow all those fresh fruits and nuts that they recommend everybody eat. They grow there year-round, and I think that's one of the major valleys where a lot of our produce up here in Washington comes from in the winter.
Yeah. Okay. This is why I think my mother-in-law is going to live to be 105. She's 85, and she's still outside every single day in the garden, digging, doing something, trimming trees, walking to the post office. We would lose her during COVID because she's out walking. She'll walk into town. Two miles away.
Nice.
And we're like, everything is shut down. But you know what? She's so healthy. Doesn't even take an aspirin. Yeah.
But you know, we in our practices have a fair percentage of 90 plus.
Yes, we do.
And it's just a joy to have them in the practice and to watch them and to listen to their stories.
All right. Well, do you want to hear a story? We've got a caller, and we think we've got the phone line problem fixed. So let's talk with Bob. We'll find out right now. Hi, Bob. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Oh, good. Yes, we can.
Loud and clear. Okay, so how can we help? And thank you for your patience.
Oh, no problem. Okay, so my wife, who's in her mid-70s, has been diagnosed with breast cancer. It's about 1 centimeter in size on her left breast. It's a stage 1, grade 2, ductal type. It's an estrogen acceptor, 90%, progesterone negative and HER2 negative. She has a family history. Her mother, her aunt, had hysterectomies, and her grandmother died at age 65. She has some genetic testing, which is pending now. So we have a ton of questions, but I've narrowed it down maybe to 4 or 5, and let me run through those.
All right.
Okay. One, should it be treated in an older person? You know, what's the growth rate for this type of cancer? The other one is, if we go to surgery, you know, with a knife, or should we opt for something like cryoablation or RF ablation? That would mean traveling maybe to the Mayo Clinic or something. I don't think any place in Washington does that. Then post-surgery, they're talking about, you know, radiation. So there's a choice there of X-rays or protons, which would mean going into Fred Hutchinson from where we live for a month. That would be probably worthwhile if it's a good option over the X-rays. And then after all of that, then there's hormone therapy, and they're talking about 5 years of that. I'm just wondering what the effect would be on a, you know, an older person taking that for that length of time. And but they're not talking about chemo, so I don't know whether chemo would really be on the list for something like this. So there's five. Anyway, so go ahead. I'm really interested to hear what you have to say.
All right. Well, to start with, this does not sound like a terribly aggressive tumor. That's the good news. You've got a fairly small lesion. You've got stage 1, which means that it's not terribly invasive. So if I were going to do radiation, I'd definitely go with the proton as opposed to the X-ray, just because it is more focused. It pretty much can be focused on a small area. And it hits just that area, and you get very little scatter. You get very little ancillary damage to surrounding tissues. So, you know, for radiation, proton is almost always my choice. Let's see.
Surgery?
The cryoablation?
Yeah.
Versus cryoablation or something like that?
Yeah.
RF ablation.
Yeah. You know, the idea is to destroy the tissue. Whether you do it with cold, whether you do it with radiation, whether you do it with a cold knife, the idea is to get the tumor itself dead, gone, or out. And so any of those are acceptable. I've not seen enough papers on cryotherapy for breast cancer to have an informed opinion. So I can't add anything there either way. You got to remember, this is not my specialty. My specialty are the normal conditions associated with aging. I'm pretty darn good at preventing breast cancer. I am less good at treating breast cancer. All right. So I generally defer to the people who do that for a living. Although I recognize that in that area, as well as every other area of medicine, people tend to stay in the middle of the road, which is it's consensus medicine. It's what most people think. And the really cutting edge, leading edge people are going to be a small number, and you're going to have to kind of hunt a bit to find them. There are two groups of physicians that have been involved in using a different set of hormonal therapies. Instead of blocking estrogens completely, which do indeed block the hormone within the tumor, but the hormonal blocking blocks all of the estrogens everywhere in the body. And as a consequence, the brain tends to get really foggy, memory starts to go, cognition declines. The women's brains need estrogen and testosterone. When you deprive them of either of those, you get some real mental problems. You also get the bones start thinning out rapidly. Osteoporosis is an expected side effect of that, especially in a woman of her age. We can almost tell you for sure that she's going to get really thin bones if you block her hormone production. An alternative to that is one that Dr. Glazier over in Ohio came up with, in which she actually uses testosterone with aromatase implants. It's a mixture. Aromatase blocks the tumor from making its own estrogen. And they mix the aromatase blocker with testosterone in a pellet, and they actually put the pellets in the breast. So the breast gets a high dose of testosterone but can't make estrogen. But the rest of the body can still get it. So she still gets estrogen for her brain, for her bones, for her skin. And the high testosterone load in the breast has a tendency to really shrink up any tumors that are there. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the studies that I've seen thus far using the testosterone therapy instead of just estrogen ablation, they were reporting that none of their people died of the breast cancer. Zero death rates. They saved everybody.
Was this before surgery? I mean, they only treated it with testosterone and aromatase?
Yes. That's right. And these were women with aggressive tumors, tumors that had, you know, that had a high propensity for spread. And so these were people that were high risk of dying of their cancer, and yet none of them died. And a woman like your wife, who appears to have a fairly indolent, not very aggressive tumor from what you've told me so far, although the genome studies will give us a lot more information on that. But, you know, if this were my wife, I would be certainly talking to some of the folks that do this sort of thing.
Dr. Glazier in Ohio be the only, or is there anyone else that does that?
Yeah, well, actually,
it would be closer.
Yeah, well, no, they're not closer. In fact, the other one that does this sort of thing is in Georgia, in Atlanta. Okay, so I don't know anybody locally that has published on this. We got to remember, I don't know what everybody locally is doing. I only know what has been published in the literature. Okay. And Dr. Glazier has published several papers. There's a Dr. Donovan, I believe it is, out of Georgia that has published a couple of papers on this. But as I say, Dr. Glazier is no longer interested in doing clinical practice. She's now moving fully to research, I think, but she has several colleagues in her institution that are now kind of her students, her acolytes, that are picking up where she's left off in the clinic. So, you know, you might look her up and contact her and say, okay, who is taking your place? Who would I see? Because if it were...
And that would be Glazier?
I think... Glaser.
S-E-R. Okay.
Yeah, Glaser. And it's Rebecca is her first name. Okay?
Okay.
And so she, and since this is her special interest, if there's anyone out here who is doing this sort of thing, she would probably know who they are.
Mm-hmm. Now, would this be something that in lieu of surgery, they would implant the testosterone and aromatase, or would it be post-surgery that they go into where that void is?
I've seen some patients that have gone both ways. I'm especially impressed with some of the photographs I've seen of the X-rays, and where you see a great big tumor, and then they put in the implants, and 6 months or a year later, the tumor has just shriveled up and is tiny. And those particular ones did not get the surgery. At least they didn't get the surgery until after the implants. And I think in that case, what they were trying to do was to shrink the tumor, make it very small, and then excise whatever residual tumor was there.
Would a follow-up be then at, so you shrink it, you cut it out, then do you do the radiation therapy as well?
I don't know. I don't know. Okay. Again, we are outside of my realm of expertise. I'm telling you what little I know of it from the papers I've read, but I am not an oncologist. I don't treat breast cancer. If I did, I'd know a hell of a lot more about this than I do.
Yeah, but if I went to scholar.google and put her name, Rebecca Glaser, in, a lot of that stuff would pop up, I would assume.
Most likely. Yeah, most likely.
And do you have a phone number? Probably not, but I can Google that and find it.
Yeah, or if you pull up one of her papers, then her contact information and emails are usually right in the paper.
Okay. Well, that's very helpful. I knew you would be.
All right. We'll do what little we know.
Yes.
Like I said, you have to recognize you're talking to a guy who is outside of my field. Dr.
Razzle wanted to add something in there. One, I'm sorry about the diagnosis, but it sounds like you caught it early. So congratulations on using screening appropriately so that this doesn't have to be a life-ending condition. It's really important for women to keep up with their screening, even in their 70s and now 80s, because they're living long enough.
That's right.
And so it's important to not skip those mammograms, whether or not you have a family history. But if you do have that family history, or you know you have dense breasts, you have to get in there every year and maybe even do other imaging. And so it's really important to let your rest of your family know whether or not it's genetic. Everybody still needs to get screened because there might be some genetics they haven't figured out yet that make it more likely to happen.
In fact, I was listening to a podcast recently where they were saying that women that have a genetic history might even need to be screened twice a year. And sometimes they have to fight with their insurance, but they do need to do that to get the imaging study done. And then MRI is the next step after a mammogram. So if you have dense breasts and you know that the lesion will not be picked up easily on a mammogram, then you need to ask for an MRI scan. And again, sometimes it's out of pocket, but a lot of times insurance will pay for it. Yeah. They should pay for this.
And even if it's not paid for by the insurance company, your life is worth it. So,
yeah. You know, the other thing that occurs to me, maybe surgery, proton, and then skip the hormone therapy. And is that because you go in and you disturb that tissue and you get some cellular migration around that, you know, some of those cells get in other places that you didn't get, and so you want to just, you know, hit it with radiation and then do the hormone as well?
It's not so much that you're worried about spreading the tumor with the surgery. It's that the tumor may have spread and you don't know it yet. Remember, the cancer starts with one cell, okay? One single cell out of the tens of billions of cells that are there. And so when it spreads with just one or two little cells that go hither or yon, and they have to grow a while before they get big enough for us to find them.
Yeah.
And the average breast cancer has been there for 5 years before we discover it.
Right.
And that's the point, is that when someone says, oh, I just got breast cancer. No, we just found the breast cancer now. It's been there for years. It started with one cell, then it was two cells, then it was four cells. But it's got to be umpteen million cells before it's big enough for us to find it.
Yeah. And, you know, the guidelines for the hormone therapy is changing as well. Post-breast cancer, they used to do estrogen blockers for 5 years. Now, in some cases, they will do only 3 years as well. Mm-hmm. And so as more and more is known about the genetic makeup of the tumor, we will be able to specifically guide every patient into how long they need to do the estrogen blockers.
Right.
That is where most of the problem comes. You know, they can get the tumor out, but it's how long afterwards do you keep the patient on therapy so that you prevent a spread of any seed that it might be somewhere else.
And we want to limit it to the shortest time period possible, because the therapies do enormous damage. They are not innocuous. So, you know, you're knocking down the cancer growth, but you're causing a lot of other complications because you're taking away things the human body requires to be healthy. Does that help?
Yeah, it seems like, too, with, you know, when you do the testosterone and the aromatase, it seems like that would be localized, so that if you had some cells that migrated other places, it doesn't seem like it's radiation, which is more broadly based over an area, as opposed to, you know, implanting something which is really localized.
Perhaps, although let me, as long as we're on this subject, let me tell you some kind of interesting stories. And this is more for prevention than it is for therapy, which, you know, with your wife, we're talking about therapy mostly. But Dr. Glaser and Dr. Donovan both have published papers. And between the two of them, they had somewhere in the neighborhood of, well, let me count this up, 25 and yeah. So about almost 4,000 patients of women who were in their 50s. And they put these were women at high risk just because of their age and gender for breast cancer. And they put them on testosterone therapy systemically. Now, this is testosterone for their whole body because testosterone is a woman's primary sex hormone. Most people don't realize that. They think of estrogen. But a young woman, when your wife was 18, 20 years old, she had three times more testosterone in her system than she had estrogen. Okay. She had a lot more estrogen than you had, and you had a lot more testosterone than she had. You ran around 1,000 to 1,200 nanograms per deciliter. She ran around 75 or 80 nanograms per deciliter of testosterone, but her estrogen was only around 20 or 25 nanograms per deciliter. So she had 2.5 to 3 times more testosterone than estrogen when she was young. And what they've done is they've said, you know, if that's what women are lacking, why don't we give them back their youthful testosterone load, the real primary hormone for young women? And so they've done that, and they've followed these women for 10 years, and they've looked at how many breast cancers they get. Now, here's the fascinating information. A woman who's had no hormone therapy in her life will average 320 breast cancers per 100,000 woman years. Okay, so if you look at 1,000 women for 10 years, 32 of them are going to get breast cancer. If you put them on the testosterone, 50 of them will get breast cancer. Okay, from 320, oh,
yeah. It drops
down to 50. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to do the other, from 32 to 5. Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay, so you dramatically reduce the number of breast cancers. Here's where it gets even more interesting. Since we know that most of those women have had that tumor for about 5 years before we discovered it, if you look at the studies and say, when was the breast cancer discovered in these women? 90% of those breast cancers that the women got were found in the first 4.5 years.
Wow.
That means that probably instead of 50, instead of 320, actual breast cancers that formed during the study were probably down closer to, 2 or 3.
Wow.
So this is something we should be doing for every woman starting in her 30s. We should not be waiting until they get breast cancer to replace their testosterone. Anyway, we have to take a break. That's
yes,
what the music's
we hear
all
the
about.
Music. So we'll take a quick break. And then, John, we're going to be back with you in just a moment. Stay right there. And if you have a question for the doctors, here's the number to call, 800-465-8770. We're going to take a break and stay right there. Back. It's Leading Edge Medicine. My name is Lynette here, along with Dr. Jerry Mixon, Dr. Samira Umat, and Dr. Brazel is here as well. And Dr. Brazel, you had another comment as we're talking about breast cancer.
Oh, yeah. So I was at a cardiology conference on Saturday, and we were going through some of the very specific risks for cardiovascular disease in women. And there's a lot of emerging evidence to show the strong overlap between breast breast cancer risk and cardiovascular risk. So women might think, well, I've got to worry about getting my mammogram, but not getting my heart checked. And we send out, or I do, as many of my patients, male or female, to get their heart checked with what we call the mammogram, which is the cardiac calcium score, which is how much of those calcium nuggets are not in your breast tissue, but in your heart tissue. But we now know that for women who think that they're immune because they've had high HDL, there's a very strong correlation between heart attack risk and breast cancer risk. So I ask all of my female patients, if you have a family history of heart disease or personally have high cholesterol, obesity, high intake of alcohol, low activity, physical activity, or a history of tobacco use, that you get your heart checked, because breasts and hearts are near each other, and there's a lot more to that story than just what I'm saying right now, because also the treatment for breast cancer can make heart disease risk even higher. So one of the things we've learned over the last few years is for many women getting treated for breast cancer, which keeps them alive from breast cancer. Don't forget, radiation, chemotherapy, the anti-estrogen therapies do let women survive breast cancer. There's a much stronger survival rate now. Many of those women will go on to get heart disease.
Heart issues.
And if they were already at high risk, it will go faster. And so that's part of the value of screening, but preventative outlook from...
I it just points to what we do at Longevity all day long, which is that the diabetes is not in isolation to dementia. It's not in isolation to cancer. You are one body, and what's happening to one organ is invariably affecting something else in your body at some level.
I remember the Women's Health Initiative study way back from 2001 or so. And then when we did the reanalysis on that in 2012 or so.
2011.
Yeah.
We call it the WHOOP study.
Yeah.
Oh.
But they looked at women who got just estrogen without the synthetic progestogen.
Yeah. Right.
And what they found was the estrogen lowered their risk of breast cancer by 30%.
Right. Yeah.
But it lowered their risk of heart attacks by 40%.
Yeah.
And it lowered their risk of colon cancer by 40%.
Dementia.
And so the problem here is that women are designed and men are designed to have certain hormone mixtures and loads. And when you give them back what they're supposed to have, they do better. Mm-hmm. And estrogen protected 30% against breast cancer, 40% against heart attacks, 42% against colon cancer. And now we're finding out that the other side of that equation, the testosterone, is even more protective against breast cancer and heart attacks.
But also, to be clear, we do have patients that come to us who've already had breast cancer. And depending on their history, they may or may not choose to go on estrogen or testosterone replacement because there's a lot going on. But we have a lot to work on for brain health. We have a lot to work on for heart health. And many women who've been treated both with surgery, chemo, radiation, and also the long-term estrogen blockers are really struggling with every other aspect of their health.
Yes.
And they also get to get help. We can't just say, you've had breast cancer, good thing you're alive, sorry to hear about it, go sit on the couch. You can have a long, vital life after breast cancer treatment if you know where to look. And it's not going to be at the oncologist's office because their job is done.
Yes.
They're not going to tell you what else you need to worry about. They can barely get on top of what you have to take care of just to get through treatment.
I mean, it's absolutely true. You know, once that specialty is done with what they're supposed to do for you, they kind of send you off to somebody else, and nobody then takes on ownership, because the primary cares literally don't exist anymore, but they also are in a bind and they don't know what to do. And that's where we excel, because we look at all of you. You know, we'll do a nutritional analysis, we'll look at your lifestyle, your cognitive health, and there is so much to you and to your life that you want to continue to enjoy. And yes, there's one aspect, but we can help improve all the other aspects of your life.
Right.
I have many patients that have had prostate cancer in men, breast cancer in women, that are not on hormones, but they're still our patients. And that's the point we're trying to make.
Yes. Yes. Oh, such a great discussion. All right, Bob, I hope you were able to get some information there. Thank you so much for your call and your questions. We're going to head back down to Arizona. And John, thank you, John, for waiting. We can hear you. How can we help?
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. I really enjoy your show. It's bringing me back home to Seattle while I'm here in Arizona. But I started out the day, you might enjoy this. to feed the birds that looking up at a blue sky, and I walk by the citrus trees, the oranges are in bloom, and the smell of the orange blossoms, and I thought, life is really good.
Yep.
But,
that time of year.
It is.
I've been a patient of Dr. Mixon's for over 20 years, and I've talked to you on the radio several times, and he's really changed our lives. But recently, I have a problem with blood in the urine, but I'd like to tell you a little story. When I had hernia surgery, and the doctor was expecting, he read all over my files, and somebody was like in a wheelchair on oxygen, and he walked in and he says, I see this 60-year-old man, and it doesn't make sense. So, anyhow, I'm actually 80, going to be 87.
Wow.
Thanks to the great care that I've had. I had to get a note from my trainers, or from the doctor for my trainers, because after 3 weeks, they didn't want me, take me to work out. But I was started on the treadmill the next day after surgery. I was doing the machines without weights that same day. In 3 weeks, I was back up to normal routine with five sets of 12 of all my upper body and lower body.
And, good for you.
Yes.
So I talked to her, and I said, well, the secret is longevity. So I gave him a copy of my story, and I said, would you like to have Dr. Mixon's book? And he says, yeah. And he says, I'll buy it. So far, I've sold two books, Dr. Mixon, to my
there
doctor.
You go.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
So, John, you were mentioning earlier that you had blood in your urine. That was
yes.
your concern for your call today?
All of our eyebrows went up when you mentioned yes. blood in your urine. So,
yeah. yeah.
Okay. Well, I changed my exercise routine to from 5 sets of 12 to 1 set of 12 to get warmed up, and then 4 sets of 5 at max weight. So, I started rapamycin about, I'm on, let's see, HGH, nystatinib, and rapamycin. I started rapamycin about on my fourth week. But, and I'm searching for my max weight. So the first 2 weeks went by pretty much non-eventful. And the third week, I'm coming up on my max weight. So, for example, on the leg press, I do like 110 a set of 12 for warm up, and then I start going up in weight. So my max weight was supposed to be 190. So I went to that felt pretty good after 5 sets. So then I did 200, and then I did 210, and everything seemed pretty good in my surge. So that evening, I started passing a little bit of blood. I didn't think much of it. I didn't really have the lights on in the bathroom. And the next morning, I still had blood going. So that lasted about a day and a half. And then I did my max workouts again, upper body, Wednesday and Friday. And then I started getting more blood in the urine. So, I better have this checked. So, I went in to the doctor, and my urine sample was clear. But he said that he checked it anyhow, and then he said, I can still see blood in the urine and also a lot of protein. So I had a blood draw Thursday, and I'll know the results next week. But he's concerned about my kidneys. Might be a problem.
Kidneys or bladder, And so I'd definitely go see a urologist and let them put a scope up into the bladder to make sure you don't have a bladder cancer or something hiding there, or a polyp. And then, of course, you need to have some imaging studies done on those kidneys, too. Maybe a good MRI.
Are you on any blood thinners?
One baby aspirin every day.
That's not going to do it. All right. Yeah. No, so we need to take...
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break, John. You stay right there, and we will be back with what some possibilities could be and what your next option is. So stay right there. And then Ed and Dan, we're going to get to your calls as well. Here is the number to get through today for Leading Edge Medicine. It is 800-465-8770. That's 800-465-8770. We'll be right back.